All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Deb. I'm a real alcoholic. Hey. Whew, yeah, she set the bar high. High expectations. I am so incredibly grateful that I learned years ago to let go of that competitive spirit when I'm at a conference that is this full of such incredibly presented stories and applications of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful that I learned a long time ago that I just get to be part of it. And we are all part of it. And I'm just grateful because there's no way I could even begin to compete with the powerful stories that God has delivered from behind this podium this weekend. Really, you ladies have brought it. Yep. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1987. I know, right? It's a long time. I still remember the day, probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, when in and around Akron, Ohio, whenever you have an anniversary, you get to stand up on the day of your anniversary and say, "My name's Deb, and I am sober X amount of years," and everybody goes, yeah. They scan the audience to find your sponsor. Your sponsor goes, and then they give a reserved clap, and you get a single coin, and you sit down. There's no cake, there's no fanfare, and there is no sprouting. Right? You don't ever announce your anniversary early. Anyway, some people are like, "What?" Anyway, I remember that day, though, a couple of years ago when I stood up to announce my anniversary, and I thought, "Oh, my God, I am now sober longer than the guy who I thought was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous when I came in." His name was Max Shadburn, and he had been sober since Christ was a child. And he was well into his 70s, maybe early 80s, and his nemesis was a woman, and her name was Jane. And Jane had been sober as long as Mac. She was as old as Mac. And she would sit in the front of the room, and Mac would sit in the back of the room, and he was the greeter, and she was the one everyone came to see. And if you stood behind the podium and you misquoted something out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you better just sit down. Because she's going to go, And she's going to turn and look at him, and he'll be like, "Oh, no." And the two of them will then commence to arguing about what proper page you should have stated. And they will inform you out loud in front of a group of people that if you can't quote it right, you probably shouldn't be showing off and you should go ahead and have a seat. And that was my Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm now sober longer than they were when I got sober. And I'm like, oh my gosh, right? The responsibility that we have. But not only do we have an incredible responsibility to ensure that we're sitting knee to knee, walking shoulder to shoulder, and crying forehead to forehead with one another, but we are responsible to understand, to have an experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous so that we have something of depth and weight to pass on to one another. You know, when I was getting sober, I had fallen into this group. So I got sober outside of Akron, Ohio. It takes about 15 minutes to get from my little town into Akron. And where I got sober, they weren't real big users of the Big Book 36 years ago. Now, the Big Book was, of course, written by those New Yorkers. So it was a smidge suspect anyway. And if you just had a better relationship with God, you probably wouldn't need all that written nonsense. Anyway, so we weren't real big users of the Big Book, but it was at every meeting, right? And every now and then somebody would quote it, right? But that was about the extent of it. And when I was getting sober, when I came in, I'm a product of group sponsorship. So when I got here, I was assigned to have Jane as my sponsor. I know. I appreciate that you sensed the heaviness that came with that for me. I feel validated somehow. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't planning on being here this long. Right? I really wasn't. I wasn't planning on really being an alcoholic. I wasn't planning on working your silly steps. I wasn't planning on falling in love with all of you. I wasn't planning on being delivered into the arms of God. I wasn't planning on learning how to pray. I wasn't planning on getting comfortable sitting in the stillness. I wasn't planning on confronting all of those demons. I wasn't planning on revisiting all of those belief systems that were keeping me stuck. I wasn't planning on learning how to actually partner with another human being. I wasn't planning on actually learning how to love you in a way that didn't need to produce outcomes for me. I wasn't planning on learning how to stand on my own two feet so that my material security wasn't wrapped up in your approval of me. I just wasn't planning on being here that long. And when I got here and they said, you know, we don't drink one day at a time, I'm like, I know that you mean the rest of my life. I'm really clear about that. You mean the rest of my life, and you are starting out on a lie. And when I got here, I was 15 years old. I know. Again, thank you for sensing how heavy that is. I really like this group participation. I think Jackie from Memphis might have been holding some classes. That's right. Oh, anyway, I got here when I was 15 years old, and when they said we don't drink one day at a time, I said, well, that's fine for all of you who are like 75, because you're going to be dead in a few years. I was just like that, just a bit of a brat. I said, but what that means for me is another 80 years of not drinking, right? 80 years of sobriety. Because I thought that when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous that this was about me not drinking anymore so that people would stop being mad at me and I would stop having the consequences of drunkenness. I didn't know that I had a soul sickness. I didn't know that there was a way of life that I was going to be shown how to participate in that was going to deliver me into the life that I live today. I remember when I was just sober a few days, a few weeks, I was talking to Jane because I had to call her on the regular, one of those requirements. And I was talking to Jane, and I could not see past my current circumstance. You know how newcomers are, right? We are all just swallowed up in that pile of problems that we bring in here with us that are astonishingly difficult to solve, right? And so we need to share them in great detail with anyone who will listen. Right. And so I am regaling Jane again with details of my enormous problem. God knows what it was. I mean, I was 15. So I don't know, you know, how earth shattering that could have possibly been, but it was earth shattering to me. And she stopped me and she said, what do you want? And I was like, well, I don't know. She said, tell me something that you want. Now, I'm not a girl that anyone ever asks, what do you want? What are your hopes? What are your dreams? What do you want to be when you grow up? Nobody was asking me those kinds of questions. Right? We were about surviving the activities of daily living. We weren't about having big dreams. Right? When I'm a little kid, my dad, who's our drunk, he looks at me and my sister, and we're sitting at the little kid table, and my mom had just gotten back from shopping, and she'd bought us some school clothes. And she always tried to hide the receipts, and he found the receipt for the money she had spent on our school clothes. And he pointed at us, and he said, I don't know why you're spending money on them. They're never going to amount to anything anyway. And I'm going to first grade. And my sister's going to third. And I watch my sister take that on board. And she literally, physically folds herself in internally. And I immediately bow up. And I said, how can somebody so big be so wrong? And that's how we've lived our lives. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I got here and started to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the old timers who were around at that time, and they were not without their fault, but oh my God, they were amazing for me. When they say things to me like, what do you want? well, she's asking me a question that I'd never heard before. And I have to get creative. And so my immediate answer was, I want to be skinny and I want a Harley Davidson motorcycle. And she said, well, quit eating French fries, go get a job in an empty coffee can. And she went and hung up on me. We used to have phones where you can do that. Right now you're like, you can't even hear it. It's got no effect. Oh, so I quit eating French fries and I got a job waitressing in a local ice cream shop, which was counterintuitive to the whole French fry thing. And I'm highly aware of that. And I got an empty coffee can from my group and I called her back and I said, I got a job and an empty coffee can. I haven't had French fries for 3 days. Now what? And she said, work every single Tuesday and put Tuesday's tips in the can. Now, a shift at the ice cream shop, I'm clearing about $2.50. Right, $2.50. I said, that's going to take forever. And she said, well, it will if you don't start. Do you hear? I mean, me pounding on the podium has more impact than this. So my very first trip through the steps, I wasn't allowed to start doing my steps until I figured out what the four absolutes were. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the four absolutes, I'm going to go through this kind of quick. So the Oxford group, which was that multi-denominational religious group of folks who had this practical program of action that would, when properly applied, would deliver you from whatever sin you were trying to overcome. Right? That group of people, they gave us the foundation for what became the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They had 28 spiritual tenets. 28. When we broke from the Oxford group so that Alcoholics Anonymous could separate from the religiosity so that we could open our spiritual aperture to welcome everyone in. When we separated, we kept with us four of those 28 spiritual tenets. And those things are called the four absolutes. And they're absolute love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. Absolute love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. And purity doesn't mean pure as the driven snow. Purity means purity of motive. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And is it the right thing to do? Right? And so I went to Jane, like I was sober for a minute. And I went to Jane and I said, Jane, you haven't started me on my 12 steps yet. If you don't start me on my 12 steps, I'm going to die. And she said, you're not ready for the 12 steps. And I said, well, they said you're not to wait. I had been to a discussion meeting. Did I say that out loud? I was full of great ideas after my discussion experience. And she said, you're not ready for the 12 steps yet. You need to go figure out what the four absolutes are. And I was like, the four absolutes? And in and around Akron and Cleveland Alcoholics Anonymous, we still have them hanging on the wall. Right? And so like we have think, and first things first, and those kinds of slogans on most AA rooms, we also have absolute love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness hanging on our walls. And I said, well, they're right there, love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. And she said, but what are they? And so I went and I looked him up in the dictionary and took her the dictionary definition. She said, nope. And I went back to that discussion meeting that had given me all the great ideas. And I walked up to the chairperson and said, can we please talk about the four absolutes? Because I need to know what they are. And so those became the topic of discussion. And you know, you're going to get all kinds of great ideas from that. And so I take notes and I go back to Jane and I said, oh, Jane, the four absolutes are. And I tell her everything that I had heard at that incredible discussion meeting. And she went, no, and you're not to go back there. Oh, my gosh. And so Mac Shadburn, who was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous, right, Jane's nemesis, Mac originally had thrown me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I tell the story. His version is probably a little different than that. But he had encouraged me to go try to control my drinking when I couldn't actually tell him that I thought I was alcoholic and that I believed that I couldn't control my drinking. He asked me the questions And all I could do was give him my very famous 15-year-old answer. And so he took $5 out of his pocket and he said, here's $5. This will get you started. Go figure it out. Like, go drink again and try to stop abruptly. And if it doesn't work, you get back here. Now, usually there are some people who go, oh. But it worked for me because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous and I did not know if I had alcoholism. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I really didn't believe that I belonged here. Now, I had a long list of consequences from my drunkenness, and I was just crawling my way out of a 9-month drunken stupor where I was mostly in a blackout. So I was highly qualified to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with that little problem is that I didn't have the desire to stop drinking. Right? The only requirement for membership is a desire. I had no desire to stop drinking. I had a desire to get out of the jam. I had a desire for the consequences to quit. I had a desire for people to not be mad at me anymore. I had a desire to not hurt. I had a desire to not go there and be with them and have that thing happen again and again and again. And I had a desire to not wake up in places and not know where I was and be filthy and black and blue and have no reek. I had a desire for all of that to stop. But my God, there's got to be another way, because I can't be sober and comfortable at the same time. My God, there's got to be another way, because I have no idea how to be in this skin, in this community, with these people, with all these expectations. I have no skills for all that. None. So there's got to be another way. And so I went out and I drank one more time. And I learned in one night that indeed I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I have a head that will talk me into drinking against my against what is absolutely best for me. My head will convince me that it'll be different this time. My head will convince me that you were really too young and you were just overreacting. Right? My head will convince me that you're not going to cross the tracks this time. That's not going to happen this time. You're not going to drink to oblivion this time. You can just have a couple and take the edge off. You've learned your lesson. My God, they kept you locked up in that treatment center. You've learned your lesson. It's just not going to be like that anymore. I have a head that will talk me into drinking against my own best interests. And I have a body that can't handle it, because the moment I swallow alcohol, the phenomena of craving is triggered in me and there is no stopping me. And that's the bottom line. So the way I survive is that I have to quit drinking. But when I quit drinking, I'm so incredibly uncomfortable. I can't sit still in your meetings. I'm so uncomfortable that I can't look you in the eye. I'm so uncomfortable that I don't trust that you actually want me to be part of your group, because I don't know how to be part of a community. I'm so uncomfortable that I am pretty sure that my dad was right. And I go back and I find all of those old messages and belief systems, and I use those as reasons why I can't be a successful member of you. Because you all know each other and you seem happy and you have friends and you go for coffee with one another and you seem connected. And I have all of these things that I've learned and been taught and people have said around me that I've just randomly picked up and applied to me. And they're all the reasons why I'm going to use to stay on the outside of you. Anyway, so I'm not allowed to start the 12 steps. We all know that the 12 steps is a pathway to freedom. It's the only way I'm going to get there. And I'm not allowed to start the 12 steps yet, because I got to figure out what these four absolutes are. And so I'm walking into a meeting one night, and I had literally gone to Jane 3 different times with all of these different definitions and explanations about what the four absolutes are, right? Absolute love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness, and she's not accepting any of it. And her nemesis, which is Mac, right, who's the president of Alcoholics Anonymous, he grabs me and he said, little one, come here a minute. Now, he had not talked to me since he had tossed me out of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And so I walked over and I was like, yes, sir. And he said, I understand Jane has you trying to figure out what the four absolutes are. I said, she is, and she doesn't like any of my answers. And he said, well, don't tell her that I told you. But the four absolutes, he said, those are the ultimate goals of recovery. Those are the things that you're going to put in place of your character defects when you get to step seven. So when she has you say that prayer, you're not giving up all the bad stuff without something to replace it. He said, you're going to replace it with love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. And I was like, okay. Took my notes. I was like, brilliant. And I went back to Jane and I was like, Jane, the four absolutes, those are the goals of recovery. Those are the things I'm going to put in the way of my character defects when I get to step six and seven. And she said, that damn Mac, I knew he'd tell you. Oh, and there they went. And there they went. And then they launched me on a vigorous course of action. They literally launched me into working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I caught them. They were having a meeting about me one day, and they were talking about because the entire group took me on as a project. And so they were having a meeting about me, and it's really lovely as a newcomer when you figure out that a whole group of people really is talking about you. Right? Like, we always think that you're talking about us, and then we get there and realize that maybe you weren't, and it's a little bit of a letdown. Right? But I happened upon them. I thought they were talking about me, and indeed they were. And it just brought me joy. And what I heard them say was, she's so young, she's going to be sober forever. So we have to sponsor her out of the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous because she will leave us one day. And when she leaves us, if she doesn't have a program that is portable, it may not last for her. If her program is dependent on her relationship with us, she will never be able to leave us. And we have to enable her to go if that's her course. And so they blew the dust off of the big book and the 12 and 12. And they got busy refreshing for themselves the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous out of our literature. And we walked through the 12 steps together. And I'm so incredibly grateful. And I always tell people, I didn't get sober in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober at donut shops after meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's what we did, right? Every night at 7 o'clock, there were some old people sitting in my driveway with the engine running, waiting on me to get in the car. Because they had divided up the 7 days of the week. And I had a Monday crew, a Tuesday crew, a Wednesday crew, a Thursday crew. Because it was in a little town that was, you know, 15, 20 minutes from Akron, and we were about 45, 50 minutes from Cleveland. And we had two meetings a week in the little town where I was getting sober, and one of them was at 10 a.m. when I was supposed to be at school if I wasn't skipping. And the other one was on Saturday night, and that was it. And so in order for me to get to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody had to come and get me and take me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they did that. That's why they had divided up the days of the week. And after every single meeting, there was a donut shop or a diner where we went. And every time we would go to that donut shop or that diner, most of them were donut shops. Those folks, you know, I was in their car, so they had to take me along whether I was being a fool or not. And we would sit there and they would let me bum cigarettes from them because I didn't smoke when I got to AA, so I had to learn. I mean, you got to fit in, right? You got to fit in. And I really got to fit in because how many times do we listen to people stand here at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about how we feel like we didn't belong? And my very life depended on me belonging here. Your very life is dependent on you belonging here. We must belong here. We must be open and inclusive, and we must give everyone a seat if they want it. And we must help them define their alcoholism and let them know that there is a place where they can come and where they can get well. I'm also not one of those people who says, well, you know, I'm alcoholic, so I'm always going to be sick. No, thank you. No, thank you. We heal here. We heal here. I am never going to go beyond the human condition. But if you tell me that I have to continue to dance with the condition I brought in here, no thank you. Anyway, they launched me on this vigorous course of action. It was out of the big book in the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was at these donut shops after these meetings. Every time we'd go into a donut shop, they bought me a cup of coffee. They bought me a powdered sugar donut. They let me bum cigarettes. Like, that was my entire diet. No wonder I had to stop eating French fries. I'm just saying. I mean, it's donuts or French fries, right? Anyway, and we're sitting at the donut shop and we're walking through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they spend a lot of time making sure that I know what alcoholism actually is. We walk through the doctor's opinion in the very front of the book because alcoholism is not defined by the consequences of our drunkenness. It is not defined by the number of car accidents and DUIs and whether we had children and had them removed by Children Protective Services or if we had the car accident that took a life. All of those things are consequences of drunkenness. They do not define my alcoholism. What defines my alcoholism is whether or not I have the allergy to alcohol. Do I have the allergic reaction that manifests itself as the phenomenon of craving? If the craving is triggered in me when I swallow alcohol, I have alcoholism. And the peculiar mental twist that goes with alcoholism is that we have the head that talks us into drinking against our will, right? But then once that is the case, then what is the solution to that? Well, Chuck Chamberlain, he summed it up very, very nicely. He was one of those spiritual gurus who was, I think he was still alive he had passed on before I got sober. Anyway, he wrote The New Pair of Glasses and he was just one of those guys, right? And many of us play his tapes over and over and over. And he said that there is only one problem, and that is conscious separation from God. And there is only one solution, and that is conscious contact with God. So if alcoholism is my problem, and it is the umbrella problem that all other problems live underneath, I have got to treat my alcoholism. Well, what am I going to treat my alcoholism with? I must have to treat my alcoholism with the only solution, which is conscious contact with God. Well, how do I have a conscious contact with God? Well, I've got to figure out, first off, what my concept of God is. Not whether or not God is, but what my perception, what my conception of God is. And that's step two. Do I believe that there is a power greater than myself? I can call that power greater than, I can give it any label that I want. I can conceive of it however I want to conceive of it, but I have to have a relationship with God. I have to have a belief that there is a God, that there is a power out there that is bigger and more powerful than me that can deliver me from this thing. And then in step three, I have to enter into some kind of deal with that power and say, okay, I have decided that you're out there, so we got some work to do. And so I am going to count to 10. You have until the count of 10 to get in the middle of this before I make a decision. That's how we started out in step three, right? Okay, God, I'm going to let you in, but you have a very small window, right? You have a very small window, so you better act quick because I am going to make a decision. I'm going to take an action because I'm going to manipulate an outcome. I'm absolutely going to manipulate an outcome unless I see a better path quick. And God was like, oh, okay. Right? I'm putting all of the... Anyway. So I have to enter into this deal with God to get started. And thank God that God does not make too hard of terms with those who seek Him. Thank God that that was enough. Right? I walked up to members of Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, well, who is God to you? What's your concept of God? And you know, not everyone can just spit that out. Right? They'll look at you like you are really asking a far too intimate question for the relationship that we have established. Right. And so they would just look at me and be like, and I'm like, well, I mean, it says in step two that, you know, we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us, you know, from sanity. So what is that power greater than yourself? What is it? Right. And so I did a lot of this research and I came up with some kind of concept where I could get started. And then I took that concept into step three. And then the first action to show that I was serious about the deal I was striking in step three was to pick up the pencil and to do my step four. And out of that first initial inventory, I had to face certain bits of truth about myself. I had to realize that I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I had to realize that I manipulated every single human being who was in my life. I had to realize that I did not believe that there was enough of anything in this world. There's not enough of any of it. There's not enough funny, not enough money, approval, food. There's not enough of anything. And so I have to go out and get mine. And if it is at your expense, so sorry, you should have been quicker. But I'm going to go get mine. And so I manipulate every single relationship that I'm participating in. And I did not know that. I did not know that. I was doing it. It was very easy to define, but I didn't really know that. And so when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no community skills. None. Right? Because nobody wants to hang out in a community with somebody who's just going to manipulate them all the time. Right? It is tough to be in a community with someone who believes that there's not enough of anything. And so they're constantly trying to be the center of attention so that they could see, so that they can get approval from people. Right? All of that. Anyway, so I go through that very first inventory process, and at the end of it, I have 16 character defects. They wrote them down for me. 16. I thought that was kind of repetitive. I mean, honestly, we could have bunched some of them together and used, you know, some umbrella terms for them, but 16 character defects. I'm like, good Lord, I'm only 15 years old. I'm all character defects. So I have 16 character defects, and through that inventory process, I understand that I use my character defects because I get scared. Every time I get scared, I try to manipulate a positive outcome, and the way I manipulate a positive outcome is by applying a character defect. I'm either lying to you, cheating you, whatever, right? But I'm going to manipulate some kind of positive outcome because I am scared that the outcome that is headed my way is not good. And so I get scared, I use my character defects, I harm you, you retaliate, and then we get into this tug of war, and it just gets uglier and uglier and uglier. And that's the pattern of my life. And I remember looking at Jane very clearly and saying, yeah, but I've actually been hungry. Yeah, but people who were supposed to keep me safe didn't. Yeah, but, right? And I had a story. I had a narrative that went along with and justified all of the ways in which I treated you poorly. And she said, yeah, but, darling, you're dying of untreated alcoholism. There is a loving God who you have never given a chance. And that loving God will stand in the gap for you. But you have to be willing to let him get in there. And I was like, what an order. I can't go through with it. Woo! I mean, that's asking a little much. It really was. It was asking a little much. And honestly, like, I mean, we were like on the fourth step when I had 5 months sober. No. No. The body of evidence that I had had piled up in support of the God idea was not high enough for me to go there yet. It just wasn't. So I could do things like take the list of opposite actions that were created for me, right? Like when I went to lie, I had to choose to tell the truth. When I went to gossip, I had to choose to keep my mouth shut. Right. So there were this list of opposites that were set opposite from each of my character defects. And she was like, OK, then at least do this. Then at least do this. She said, are you willing to at least do that? And I said, fine, I'll give that a try. And that was enough. Because God will meet us where we are. A good sponsor will meet us where we are. I have learned in my days of being sponsored and of being a sponsor that surrender is a process, not an event. And that as the process of surrender continues, my willingness will deepen. My commitment to the process will deepen. My faith in the outcomes will deepen. My trust that you're going to be there and have my back on those really ugly days will be there. But it wasn't there initially. And so we started with the list of opposites. And I got on my knees for... my very first 7-step prayer, and I of course closed one eye because I really did not yet understand that there's no wrong way to pray. Right? And so I opened the book, found the 7-step prayer, closed one eye, got down on my knees because we had to pray on our knees where I got sober. And Jane was sitting there, and I read the 7-step prayer. And then I kind of looked around and I was like, "Now what?" And she said, "Get up and act like he took them." Because I had just asked for all those character defects to be removed. And, you know, she's like, "Well, your part is to act like they're gone. They may not be, but give it a try." Right? I mean, for the love of God, child, give it a try. And so that's how I started on this journey. And I have to tell you that every single time I have revisited a 4th and a 5th step, every time I have been in that process, that list of character defects at the end, I've learned how to consolidate them. But many of them are still there. They just manifest themselves a little differently. Right? We had a lovely meeting at this women's group that I go to. My friend Kim is here, and she brought the topic. I'm now allowed to go to discussion meetings as long as they're properly structured. I said that out loud, too. Anyway, so there's this lovely women's meeting. Someone brings the topic. We all stick to the topic. It's properly structured. And Kim brought the topic of honesty, and she's sober over 3 decades. And she wants to talk about honesty and what it means in our lives today. And what she's really talking about is the application of the principles in the process of Alcoholics Anonymous over time. You see, because baseline honesty for us when we all get sober, some of that stuff is pretty simple to knock out, right? Put the candy bar back if you're not going to pay for it. I mean, it's, right, like simple honesty, right? Do you like this? Say no if you don't, right? Take the risk that no is okay. You know, do you like eggs runny or soft? Make the decision. Your life's not going to end either way, right? But learn how to get honest about the little things. But now at 30-some years sober, what does honesty mean? At 30 years sober, when I go back to those 4 absolutes and I look at my progress toward them, absolute love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness, absolute honesty for me today means that I tell you the truth no matter what. And I now trust that if that means that you have to take a moment and remove yourself from my company or no longer be part of my community, I'm going to be okay anyway. If I tell you what I believe to be true, and I say it in a loving and gentle and kind way, but it is absolutely what I believe to be true after some prayerful time spent with my higher power, and some inventory work, and if it's a meaningful ask, if I tell you that and I believe that it's true and you leave me, I'm going to be okay. You see, my greatest fear, the chief activator of all of my character defects, was the fear that I was going to be abandoned. And not only was I going to be abandoned, but I was going to be abandoned before I had the skills to take care of myself. And let's face it, when we get here, we don't have a lot of skills to take care of ourselves. Right? And so my primary fear, when you took everything that was going on in my life and you said, "What is the absolute worst thing that could happen if they think that negative thing about you?" I'd be like, "Well, they would leave me." Well, what would happen if they left you? Well, the truth was, you would take away those things that you gave me. And they're like, "Oh, so your relationships are still transactional at 20 years sober. I'm still interested in the relationship I have with you because of what you add to my life. So how is it that I can deepen the experience of love and love you for who you are, and love you because you're just another precious child of God, and expect nothing from you because I've chosen to love you. But talk about vulnerability. Talk about having to be willing not only to say that there is a God and be able to describe that God and tell you lovely stories of how God has interacted in my life and brought about miracles and healing and delivered me through hard times, because I can do all of that. And I have some great stories, right, Beth? I've got great stories, right? I can do all of that. But on an average day, can I sit in the stillness? And can I 100% rely on God to provide to me everything that I need? You see, in the fourth step, in the 12 and 12, it talks about that we have these basic instincts, right? We all want to be somebody, have somebody, and have all of our needs met, right? Sex, status, and security. We all want to be somebody, and have all of our basic needs met. Well, why do I manipulate? Why do I lie? Why do I cheat? Why do I tell a half-truth? Why do I avoid your eye contact so hopefully I don't have to have that conversation with you? Why do I do all of that? Because for some reason, that interaction, I believe, either has the ability to deliver me to or deliver me from getting those three basic instincts met. Right? We all want to be somebody. Right? We all want status. That's why I said that my very life depends on my ability to belong here. So what that means is that I better learn how to be a good member of this community. I better act in a way where you all want me to come back. I better be that person who acts right. I better become that person who becomes dependable because my actions are right and kind and loving and honest. And you can come to me when you're having a really bad day. And you want me to be part of this community because my very life depends on my belonging here. So what am I doing to continue to clean house and become that person? I have to learn how to love differently. I have to learn how to love differently. I have to deepen what honesty actually means. Every time I go to interact with you about a topic that is of some difficulty or importance, I have to look at that interaction and say, why do I think or feel that way about that topic? What is my motive in having this interaction? What is my actual motive here? Is my motive to create harmony and unity? Or is my motive to make sure that you think better of me than you did yesterday? Is my motive to be voted in as chair? Or is my motive literally to become a trusted servant who can be used in any capacity necessary? Right? So are my thoughts, my feelings, and my actions, are those things in alignment to create harmony and loving situations, or are they in alignment to actually destroy so that I can be elevated? Right? We all want to be somebody. We all want to have somebody. Oh my goodness, we all want to have somebody. Right? This is why we do the sexual inventory. And this is why the sexual inventory can become a conduct inventory. And in the use of that conduct inventory, we can take a look at how do I actually carry myself in all of my relationships today? In all of my relationships. Cindy, I think, was talking a little bit earlier about, you know, who struggles to have friendships? Right? Who in this room struggles to have friendships? Well, what kind of friend am I? Right? What kind of friend am I? What do I bring to those friendships? Am I that reliable person? Am I dependable? Am I loving? Am I kind? Am I honest? Can you come to me in your hardest day? Am I the person that when I tell you that I'm going to call you, do I actually call you? If you call me, do I actually return your call? Right? What kind of friend am I? And if I'm not, why not? Those are the kinds of inventories I do today, right? If I'm not calling you back, why am I not calling you back? What are my motives there? And is that just another application of self-centeredness, right? I mean, this, anyway. So you feeling me? Yeah. But all of this requires me to participate in a level of vulnerability that I'm not used to. Even today, this requires me to participate in a level of vulnerability that I'm not used to. I have to sit quietly and not do anything a lot of the time today and see what God is putting together for this particular situation. I have to sit quietly and allow God to inform my actions, which means that I have to have patience, which means that I have to sit in the stillness and I have to be still and I have to allow things to play out. And that is not one of my strong suits. I am really someone who likes to get in there and make things happen. I really do. I love to get in there and make things happen. But that's not my job today. Absolutely not my job today. But we all want to be somebody and we all want to have somebody. How many times have I sponsored girls? How many times have I myself taken actions to create a relationship that was absolutely inappropriate and not good for me? Right? Not good for me, not good for the person, but I'm in the relationship anyway because for whatever reason, I believe that that person is someday somehow going to be able to take better care of me than I can myself. I know. Oh my gosh, that drives so many of us, doesn't it? The number of women that I've sponsored and they've literally, why are you still in that relationship? And when they do the inventory work, they're in that relationship because they believe that he is going to be able to provide for them. They're not there because there's love. They're not there because there's commitment or dedication. They're there because they want that man to produce the things of security for them. And so when we talk about the application of step 6 and 7, when we talk about doing the next level of inventory, these are the kinds of things that we're talking about. And it's significant and it's substantial. And I can't do any of that if I don't have a relationship with God that continues to grow. I can't do any of that if I haven't grown in my ability to trust and rely on God. I can't do it. When I was about, I only have a few minutes. When I was about, 18 or 19 years sober, I had finally met the right man for the right reasons in the right order, right? He was really cute. He was a Marine. He was big. He was bald. He was, people followed him just because he was walking somewhere, including me. And we rode Harleys together and we golfed together. And I was sober a long time. And he was just a good guy who didn't need to be sober. And what was happening for me in that relationship is that I was spending more and more and more time with him. And someone said, well, you've always said that you wanted to be in a relationship with someone who loved God the way you loved God. And I said, yeah, but he's pretty good. And I can, I got this. I can be spiritual enough for both of us. Oh my God. I was absolutely serious about that. Right? Because I was like, no, it's not, it's none of my business, what kind of relationship he has with God. And everybody was scratching their heads and they're like, that's not what you've been saying for years. Like, you're not even living up to the things that you've set out for yourself. And I'm like, but he's really cute. Right? And he's really nice and he's all of those things. Anyway, and what has happened for me in my life is that because I have this relationship that has continued to build over the years with God, that God comes to me and he puts me through these spiritual rearrangements. That's what I like to call them, spiritual rearrangements. It's actually where I am acting poorly and God gets in the middle of it and says, no, right? It is progress, not perfection, but you are not progressing. And I have an idea of what perfect should look like, and you're not getting anywhere closer to it, right? And so you will change the way you're acting. Anyway, and so God gets in the middle of all of this, and I have one of those moments in my life where the only place that I am comfortable is on my knees in prayer and meditation. Like, I'm not comfortable sitting in an AA meeting. I'm not comfortable on an airplane in the silence. I'm not comfortable anywhere anymore. And God continues to come to me when I'm sitting, when I'm literally on my knees and I'm having this conversation with him, and I'm like, God, enough. I am exhausted. right? I'm up at 5 a.m. and I'm just in prayer and meditation all day long. It's the only place I can be. It's just this brutal moment in time. And God is having his way with me. And what he says to me is, I have perfect love to give you and you continue to block me. Why do you do that? I want you to be with someone who loves me the way you love me. You're blocking me. I have that for you. And I've always been the girl that has settled for good enough rather than holding out for the best. Because I don't trust that the best is coming. I don't believe that I deserve the best. Right? When you look at self-worth, right? I'm the girl that believes I'm not worth any of it. And so I'm going to settle for good enough. Because he's handsome and he's kind and he tells the truth and he is, and people follow him because he's walking somewhere and all of that stuff. And we, right? And we ride Harleys together and we go, like, he's my best friend. Like, it's good. And I'm like, God, have you seen him? I mean, can we get honest about this, right? Like, because I'm pretty sure that God does not know what handsome is. And so we are going back and forth about this and God keeps coming to me in meditation and saying, stop. You are blocking me from giving you the perfect love I have for you. And finally, I could not ignore it any longer. And so I went home from this particular conference and I met with Lee and I said, look, I'm going to need to break up with you. And he said, why? And I said, because God has had his way with me. I said, and I need to be with someone who loves God the way I love God. And he said, well, I love God. And I said, you do? I said, you don't even pray. Like, you have no relationship with God. And he said, I know, but I was raised in church. And I was like, but you have no relationship with God, and I need to be with someone who does. And I have to let you go. And he said, are you sure there's not another man? And I was like, oh, God, that'd be so much easier. Right? I know how to do that. Right? I know how to do that. Anyway, and so we end that relationship, and I walk away, and I pick up this entirely new spiritual practice. And I'm spending more and more and more time with God, and I'm exploring this whole different path to him. And I'm using new tools. I'm learning rhythmic prayer and some other things. And I am just deepening and deepening and deepening. And I'm like, God, you promised, right? You promised I am here. Now what do you got? And what I didn't know was that Lee was his name. When I broke up with him, he went to his battalion chaplain, because he was a Marine. He went to his battalion chaplain and said, Chaps, Deb left me. And the chaplain said, well, Deb's pretty great, man. What did you do? And he said, she said that I'm in the way of perfect love that God has for her. And Chaps said, well, what is she doing? He said, she's going and doing all of this new religious stuff. And he said, well, what is she doing? And he said, she's going to become Catholic. Catholic. And the chaplain said, well, Deb's pretty great. I think I would go to Mass if I were you. And so the next day, Lee comes and finds me, and I'm sitting in this adoration chapel, sitting in the stillness, in the middle of a set of rhythmic prayers, because that's the only place that I can find solace. And Lee comes and finds me in that little chapel. And he has an engagement ring. And he said, if it's Catholic, it's Catholic. I'm in. And you see, what I learned from that is that I had an active relationship with God. I had a deepening of my spiritual center. I was learning new spiritual pathways and tools. I may have just been blocking God from Lee. And that when I got out of the way, God got in the middle. And delivered him to me. And he and I then formed a spiritual bond that we would not have been able to have otherwise. We joined the same spiritual walk. We joined the same church because he wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't have a spiritual language. And so I couldn't have said to him, how do you want me to pray for you today? Because talking about God wasn't part of our relationship. And when I got out of the way, God got busy and delivered me that experience of perfect love that he had for me. And it was with the really cute guy that I had already selected. I just didn't have enough faith to stay the course. And God had to get in the middle of all of that for me. So my very favorite priest, his name is Father Targonsky. We called him Father Ski. And Father Ski was about this tall. And he was a bodybuilder, and he was a Navy chaplain who had deployed with Marines a lot, so he had a lot of rough edges. But he was a Franciscan, and he was just absolutely my favorite priest. He's the one that brought us into the faith, and he baptized us and taught me all kinds of things, and I had all kinds of private conversations. Like, he taught me how to say the rosary and why rhythmic prayer is important and how to adapt it for sponsees that I was working with and all that kind of stuff. And Father Ski went away to do a retreat for a bunch of nuns, for a bunch of Franciscan sisters in Chicago. And he comes back and he said, I missed being with, it was during Mass the next week. He said, I'm so sorry I missed all of you last week, but I was off doing this retreat for these Franciscan sisters. He said, and there was a sister, she was 98 years old, and they were celebrating her 80th year as a Franciscan sister. 80 years. He said, and so they had a big party for her. He said, and I had a chance to sit with her while she was waiting on the elevator. He said, and I sat next to her and I said, sister, it is absolutely amazing that you've been that faithful to God for 80 years. And he said, she just tapped me on the knee and she said, oh, Father, you couldn't be more wrong. It is He who has had faith in me for 80 years. Not the other way around. And he shared that in his homily, and I was like, oh my gosh, is that not true for us? Is that not true for us? We can do this thing for 80 years, and God will continue to be true to us. God will continue to be faithful to us. God will continue to meet all of our needs, to fulfill all of our instincts. And sometimes we just need to not talk. We need to not say that thing out loud. We need to say a couple of extra prayers. We need to think about what is absolutely true and honest. And we need to choose the path that makes us more vulnerable to one another. And we need to trust that our sisters will have our backs. And that's a tall order some days. Ladies, it's been lovely to be part of you. Thank you.